They talked for almost half an hour before Tom realized how hungry he was. He took pity on Joe and helped him from the suite, taking the steps slowly as he led him toward the kitchen. It was well after midnight, and there were sleepy-looking people all over the place, though a few of them had actually gone to bed. Some seemed to have already adjusted to the change, able to stay up all night and sleep throughout the day. Ryan and Spencer, sitting in the second-floor corridor, were two such people. Tom didn't look at them. The last thing he needed was to be once again sized up by Ryan Ross. There were a few dandies standing in the foyer, and another in the small parlor. Those who'd stayed behind to keep an eye on the humans. Tom led Joe past them, and pretended not to see the way the hunter took note of them, planning out escape routes, and no doubt putting together some sort of scheme in his head. It was none of his business, Tom thought. He just wanted something to eat. They never made it to the kitchen. At first, Tom wasn't sure what was happening. There was a loud crash from the outside, the sound of twisted metal and broken glass. Then he saw the orange glow of flames before he heard the crackle or felt the heat. The curtains in the parlor were on fire, Tom realized. The house was burning. It didn't take long for the front door to fly open, for hoods to start streaming in and humans to start screaming. What few dandies were in the house ran to the foyer, but Tom quickly lost sight of them in the chaos. They had to get out. Tom looked around frantically, searching for a way out. The kitchen had a back entrance, but even as he and Joe ran toward it, he could hear the door being knocked down, hear the voices of two vampires standing in the middle of the room, laughing about prim and proper dandies and their kitchen, of all things. Tom grabbed Joe's hand and spun around, making his way down the corridor, heading for a back staircase he'd found on his first day of exploration. It was meant for servants traveling between floors, and though most of the openings had been sealed, it did still reach the attic. Tom dragged Joe behind him, pulling insistently as the other boy stumbled. "Going up isn't going to help us," Joe snapped. "We can get to a balcony," Tom yelled. "I can't jump," Joe yelled back. Tom stopped in his tracks, a sinking feeling in his stomach. How many other humans had been given the same suggestion? There'd been a few surly people in the house, but that could be for any number of reasons. They were going to die. "Joe, listen to me," Tom insisted. He grabbed Joe by the head and resisted when the hunter tried to pull away. "Leave the house, Joe." "Are you fucked up? I can't," Joe yelled. "No," Tom said. "Listen to me, okay? Just listen. I need you to listen." The problem was, Tom didn't know how his ability worked. He'd only done it a few times, and never on purpose. Hell, half the time he'd been convinced there was no ability at all. How stupid was it to think that he could deliberately use it now? Still, he had to try. He was desperate. "Leave the house, Joe," Tom said. "You can leave the house." There it was, a strange feeling in his chest. Tom could feel it, like something in the world was rearranging itself to fit his needs. Joe was blinking at him, a little confused for a moment, before he reached up and rubbed at his eyes. "I think," he began. "We don't have time," Tom said. He turned then and continued up the stairs, pulling Joe along with him. They burst into the attic and found a boy with brown hair, no older than 16, trying to hide himself in a corner. Tom made an impatient noise in his throat and grabbed him too, running with both him and Joe, dodging neat rows of cots, piles of clothing and other personal belongings. They nearly all fell down the stairs at the third floor when the kid lost his footing, but Tom managed to stay on his feet. He jumped down the last four steps, arms pinwheeling wildly to catch his balance. There were screams coming from the main staircase. They were cut off abruptly, and it was the lack of sound more than anything else that worried Tom. It wasn't long before one of the hoods made his way to the third floor, stopping at the top of the stairs, smiling to see the three humans standing together. He came forward, but Tom pushed at Joe and the other kid, yelling at them to go back upstairs. The kid did as he was told, but Joe stayed where he was, not willing to leave Tom on his own. Tom didn't know whether he should be grateful or annoyed. There were two of them now, but the vampire was bigger, stronger. It was almost nothing for him to grab Tom around the throat and fist his hand in Joe's shirt. Tom could barely breathe, but he was able to kick out at Joe, catching him in the stomach, digging the toe of one polished shoe down the zipper of his hoodie. Joe was smart. He stripped off the sweater and ran for the stairs. He looked back momentarily, but Tom closed his eyes against his gaze, willing him to just keep running. When Tom opened his eyes again, Joe was gone. He thought he was going to puke when he felt himself being dragged forward toward the stairs. Had Joe gotten enough of a head start? Did it even matter when there were so many vampires in the house already? When the air was getting hotter and hotter with every second, the flames licking along old plaster and fine fabrics. The hood dragged Tom down to the second floor, laughing when he caught sight of something at the far end of the hallway. Tom could barely see, the lack of air making black spots dance across his vision. But after blinking a few times, he was able to make out three familiar shapes. Joe, with Ryan and Spencer, ducking into one of the sleets. The vampire followed, dragging Tom, limp as a ragdoll, along with him.
"You're going to break your own necks,"
the hood called, throwing open the door and stepping into the suite. The humans were clustered together on the balcony, Spencer's eyes wide with fear, one of Ryan's hands clutched between the both of his. There was a quiet panic on Ryan's face, but he was determined to hide it as well as he could. Joe just looked sorry. Tom hated him a little for that.
"It'll be easier if you just let us do it for you. Who knows, we might keep you for a while. I'm sure Greta would like company."
Greta. Greta! She was still alive! Tom held tightly to that piece of information, kept repeating it over and over in his head. "Greta! Greta! Greta!" Joe's mouth was moving, but he was speaking too softly for Tom to hear. He could read his lips, though. "I'm sorry." Tom closed his eyes so he didn't have to watch Joe grab Ryan and Spencer and drag them over the railing. He heard the boys screaming as they fell, and that was bad enough.
"How does it feel to know they won't fight for you?"
the vampire asked.
"Humans are always doing stupid, pointless things, but not for you."
Tom didn't rise to the bait. He kept his eyes closed as he felt fingers tighten in his hair, his head being jerked roughly, painfully, to the side. He held his breath and scrunched his face up as he waited for the sting. He'd never been bitten before.
All he could hear were the terrified screams from 18 months ago.
The pleading and the dying. Now it would be him. Before it could happen, Tom found himself flying across the suite, smashing into the sofa and bouncing over the back, hitting the floor with a thud. He could hear snarling and screaming, the sick sounds of fists meeting flesh. He moved slowly, peeking over the back of the sofa, afraid of what he'd see, even though he knew who it was. Alex was bleeding badly from a gash across his forehead. He'd been hit with something heavy, probably a piece of wood broken from some piece of furniture. As Tom watched, the hood twisted his wrist, snapping the bone clean in half. Tom's hands clamped over his ears, but he couldn't turn away.
Alex had tried to save him. Tom owed him that much.
Alex fought like an animal, twisting his broken wrist out of the hood's grasp, digging his nails into any soft flesh he could find, and kicking out, making his opponent stumble back a few paces. There was so much blood after a few minutes that Tom couldn't tell what belonged to whom. Both vampires were starting to tire due to the blood loss, but Alex was obviously struggling more. Tom took in a shaky breath and forced himself to his feet. He coughed a little as the room began to fill with smoke, but there was a breeze coming in from the open doors. He turned his head and took a deep breath before slowly moving closer to the two vampires. One of the tables had been upended, its legs pulled loose. It wasn't easy to break one off, but soon Tom had a makeshift weapon, the solid wood heavy in his hands. Tom rallied the strength he had left and darted forward, bringing the club down against the side of the hood's head. There was a sickening crunch as the vampire fell to his knees. Alex quickly reached out and killed him. Tom stood there for several moments, rocking back and forth on his feet as he stared down at the dead vampire, his body turning to ash before Tom's eyes. It was horrifying, but he couldn't turn away, not until a coughing fit took hold, making him double over. "We need to get out of here," Alex said, voice hoarse. Tom looked at him again and saw the deep purple bruising on his throat. Someone had choked him.
"You're hurt," Tom blurted. "I've had worse," Alex said, though Tom didn't think he could believe that.
Still, he let Alex take his wrist and pull him toward the balcony. The suite was so hot the wallpaper was starting to blister and bubble. They didn't have a lot of time. Alex did his best to pick Tom up, though it was a half-assed sort of carry. Tom didn't complain. Not even when he was falling, and then hitting the ground below. They managed to crawl across the grounds to where a small cluster of dandies and humans had gathered. It wasn't safe, Tom knew, not when there might still be hoods in the house, ready to jump from a window at any moment. There was nothing else to do, though, not when they were all injured. He wondered what they were going to do come sunrise. The house would be ash by then. He tried not to let it bother him. There had to be a contingency plan. Dandies loved contingency plans. "Alex," Tom said, his voice hoarse and so very quiet.
"Are you okay?"
He was so pale, holding himself very, very still.
"No, Tommy. I don't think I am," Alex said.
He barked out a laugh, but it made him wince.
"Here," Tom said. "Come here."
He wasn't thinking, not clearly, and maybe that had something to do with slamming his head into the ground. This was Alex. Alex, who hadn't gone with the others to look for Nate and Michael, but who'd come back just in the nick of time, who'd fought his way through the house to save him. Alex's teeth sliced cleanly through the skin of Tom's neck. It hurt, but then Alex was mouthing at his skin, sucking gently while he pulled Tom closer. It was almost nice then, so easy to close his eyes and be somewhere else, out in the sunlight, walking along the lake shore, his bare feet sinking into the hot, hot sand.
"I'm an illusionist."
Tom didn't care. He thought that maybe he should, but it was too hard to summon up the emotion. When Alex lifted his head several minutes later, Tom sighed. He pressed his face to Alex's shoulder, moving slowly and with some difficulty to tuck himself against the vampire's side. His eyes were so heavy. He was so tired. He'd nearly fallen asleep when he heard the sounds of approaching cars, the squeal of brakes,
the desperate sounds of expensive-soled shoes on pavement, and frantic voices calling out for loved ones. In the distance, Tom could hear the scream of a siren, but not even that could convince him to open his eyes. Mike hadn't been overly enthusiastic about leaving the safe house in the care of so few vampires, but he'd kept his protests to himself. He had no intention of staying behind, even if basing a rescue plan on rumors reported by a hunter of all people was a terrible idea. Mike Carden was many things, but he wasn't the kind of bastard who left dandy fledglings to the hoods. The building-to-building search hadn't turned up any dandy people. Not even Greta, who Mike had figured right from the beginning was dead. He was a little surprised that they still hadn't found her. The rest of their humans had been dumped in public places. Celeste in a restaurant dumpster, Erica in the park, Brent under Samson Bridge, and Caleb in the alley between two clubs. That was probably the cruelest of them all, leaving the kid for Sean to find himself. It made Mike grateful that Tom had come to his senses. He pictured the boy the way he'd seen him earlier in the night, sitting next to the unconscious Hunter in Briar's suite. A wonderful image of fine, dandy dress and impeccable manners. That was the way things were meant to be, Mike knew. It's the way things would have been if he hadn't felt the need to show off by keeping a human pet far longer than he should have, by marking him so often that the small bit of mesmerism he'd done had finally dissolved. He'd been lost in thought when the butcher reached for the phone vibrating in his breast pocket, going over the things he and Tom were going to do first, the places he wanted to show him in the city. But Mike wasn't so oblivious that he missed the immediate tension in the butcher's body, or that he couldn't pick out the soft, tinny sound of Siska's panicked words. The house is burning! Briar hadn't come with them, neither had Greenwald, but in that moment Mike wished they had. It felt entirely too much like a setup, and Mike was suddenly possessed with the urge to hit something, to break it into smaller and smaller pieces until finally there was nothing left. There would be consequences if that something was an envoy, but Mike was willing to take his chances. Maybe someone would understand. After all, if Schechter could talk his way out of anything, there was no reason why Mike couldn't do the same. He and John both pulled out their phones as well, no doubt equally relieved that they hadn't kicked up more of a fuss when they'd agreed to carry such devices. Each began calling other dandies as they hurried out of the warehouse, to where yet another sleek black sedan was waiting for them. Eagleside was an incredibly long street, and the gang was spread fairly thin as they made their way in small groups through whatever buildings looked promising for hiding stolen people. News spread quickly, and by the time John pulled away from the curb, most of the others were already in their cars. Mike twisted around in his seat and watched as, one by one, each car merged onto the road, creating the most ridiculous caravan he'd ever seen. "This was a bad idea," the butcher said, gripping the door handle tightly in his right hand. "It had to be done," Mike replied. He was a little surprised to realize he meant it. Judging by John's look of surprise in the rearview mirror, Mike wasn't the only one. "Drive faster," he said after a moment. It was a useless instruction. There was no way the car could go any faster than it already was, but the attention was making him uncomfortable. He stared out the window and tried not to let his imagination get the best of him. Not even his imagination could prepare him for what he saw when John threw the car into park and jumped out all in the same instant. The manor was engulfed in flames, the old house having gone up like so much kindling. Mike hoped no one had been left alive inside, because there was no way they'd be rescued. He watched the flames lick higher and higher,
reaching for the attic. He stood there, almost in a trance, barely feeling the heat on his face. How long had it taken for the fire to spread? How long had it been burning before Siska had gotten to a phone? Siska. Even thinking the fledgling's name was enough to pull Mike from his trance, to force him to turn to the group of survivors he'd seen from the corner of his eye. He could stand there all night if he wanted to, watching the safe house burn. But no matter how worried he was to do one of John's stupid head counts, it wouldn't change the outcome. The first thought that struck him was how there were so few people who'd made it out. Siska was there, face covered with soot, his head against the butcher's shoulder as they both watched the house burn. He was the only vampire to get out alive. Meg spared a thought for the three others who'd stayed behind, all of them good men that he'd known for decades. He took his time as he looked the survivors over one by one, purposely drawing it out, wanting to delay the possible moment of bad news as much as possible. Brendan was leaning over Ryan, who was lying on his back in the grass, trying to fend off Brendan's offered wrist. Mike didn't blame him. Things had been terrible for the kid the last time Brendan marked him. Given that situation, Mike himself would take the slow healing process, too. John was examining Spencer's wrists, both of which were badly swollen and probably broken. The kid didn't look like he was panicking, though it was possible that he was the sort to do it quietly. He looked upset, though, and didn't protest when John pulled him closer. The hunter was there, too, which surprised Mike more than he was willing to admit. He'd been the one to mesmer the kid, to prevent him from leaving the house. Mike didn't let himself wonder if that was why so many hadn't gotten out. Siska had mentioned hoods on the property, in the house. There was no way to prove it either way, but if Joe was there, that meant someone had broken Mike's suggestion. The only other mesmerist in the gang was Brendan, and he'd been heading his own search team. Could a human boy, who knew nothing of how mesmerism worked, who shouldn't possibly have been able to use whatever small amount of power had come to him through repeated markings, have managed to do it? Mike turned a little to the left and allowed himself to look at the last two people sprawled in the grass. One was Greenwald. Of course, Mike thought snidely. He would have survived because dying in the fire would just be too easy for everyone involved. Not only had he come to rub salt in old wounds, but the arrogance, the audacity of his visit had left Mike almost dumbstruck. At least he looked half dead, pale and bloody, and far more injured than Mike had seen another dandy in a very long time. It couldn't have happened to a more deserving person. Mike was maybe willing to admit that part of his anger was due to the fact that Tom was tucked up against his side, holding tightly to Greenwald's ruined clothes. He was either asleep or unconscious. Even from so far away, Mike could see the smudge of blood on his throat. Alex had been sloppy. Hands clenched tightly at his sides, Mike forced himself to take deep breaths. He wanted to go over there, grab his boy, and put as much distance between him and Greenwald as possible. But something kept him rooted in place, unable to move. Maybe it was Tom's fingers, fisted in Alex's coat, or the way he'd burrowed into his side. There was a time when Tom would have done that to him. The sound of breaking glass saved Carden from having to decide what to do. He turned back toward the house just in time to see two figures jump from the attic window. He recognized Briar immediately, but he wasn't sure about the kid in his arms. Judging by Quinn's sudden flurry of movement, he knew exactly who it was. The other dandy darted forward, and Mike followed, if only to give himself something to do. It felt good to move, to turn his back on the scene in the grass. Briar was in bad shape. He'd taken the brunt of the impact, and Mike could smell the sharp, unpalatable tang of vampire blood. He took stock of the envoy's injuries, finding several broken bones, a dislocated shoulder, and no doubt a lot of internal bleeding. A human would have died instantly, but Briar drew in a wet, shuddery breath. "Why would you do that?" Mike asked. He knelt down in the dirt next to Briar and flicked a glance over to Quinn, who'd managed to wrestle the kid out of Briar's tight grip. The boy was young, maybe 16, with a small scar on his jaw. He was unconscious, probably suffering from smoke inhalation if his ragged breaths were anything to go by. But he'd survive. "I didn't intend..." Briar said. He turned his head a little and spat out a mouthful of blood. Mike didn't know what he was supposed to say to that. "Of course not. This isn't your fault." That would be a lie. They'd walked into a trap because of Briar's information. "You couldn't have known?" "He'd gotten his information from a hunter. Even if the kid hadn't been in on it." And one look at him told Mike that he probably hadn't been. It was easy enough to plant false stories around town. But then again, it had been up to them to agree to the plan. Mike couldn't even blame John, because they'd all gone willingly enough, eager to find Nate and Michael, and maybe even Greta. After staying so close to home, after so much worry, they jumped at the chance. "Here." Quinn all but pushed Mike aside, offering his wrist to Briar, who took it instantly. Mike watched the two, momentarily flicking his gaze over to the human boy lying not far away on the grass, before making an impatient sound low in his throat and pushing Quinn away.
"I'm older than you," he said. "Stronger. Just get out of the way."
He let Briar feed for several long minutes, until it started to hurt far too much, sharp pains in his chest and an ache in his wrist. He drew away then, and Briar let him, his hands falling back to his sides and eyes falling closed. In that moment, Mike couldn't help but think of Greenwald, of his life slipping away and Tom leaning over him, urging and insistent. The give of his skin, a sharp teeth tore through, the warmth of his blood. A tiny murmur as Tom tried to get used to such unfamiliar sensations.
"We need to get out of here."
Mike looked up to see John standing not far away. There were other humans, too. The fire department, moving closer, ready to battle the flames in case they spread. The house was already gone, but maybe they wouldn't have to deal with a forest fire if the flames spread the half mile to the park.
"Where are we going to go?" Quinn asked. "You had a safe place. The rest of us stayed here."
"If we have to sleep side by side on my floor, then that's what we'll do," John said firmly.
"But I don't think that'll be the case. We should be able to take over a floor at the Regency. But we've got to go, Quinn. Spencer and Ryan need to go to the hospital. Hell, so do Tom, Joe, and Anthony."
He looked at the unconscious boy next to Quinn in a pointed manner.
"There's only a few hours until sunrise." "Then let's go," Quinn said, getting to his feet and hauling his boy in a fireman's carry.
Mike got to his feet, his vision swimming momentarily. He blinked furiously for a second, before it refocused again.
You all right?
John asked.
Fine, Mike replied, straightening his tie despite the fact that he was a mess and his clothes were most likely ruined from the soot, dirt, and blood. He looked down at Briar for a moment.
There was no way he could carry him.
Luckily, two others appeared, each grabbing one of the elder dandy's arms and putting it over their shoulders. Briar stumbled along the uneven ground, determined to keep up with John and Cardin. Without even needing to be told, Mike took care of the curious firefighters. He made a mental note to get them on the payroll. If he had his way, there would be a lot more burning buildings in the coming days. John got them settled remarkably quickly, calling ahead and speaking directly with the night manager, booking every room on the top floor and making sure that housekeeping or other staff be kept away from those rooms. Those who didn't have humans went there directly, taking the injured dandies with them, making sure they got safely to their beds. The rest rode together to the hospital, taking two cars. John, Spencer, Joe, Ryan, and Brendan in one. Mike, Tom, Quinn, and the boy whose name turned out to be Anthony in another. They lost Joe almost as soon as they got to the hospital. They'd all expected that, though, so no one bothered to look for him. Money changed hands, doctors were pulled off other cases, and examinations quickly performed. Mike had been right about John's boy. Both his wrists were broken. Brendan's had a dislocated shoulder and soft tissue injuries to his back. Tom was lucky. While his throat was black and blue, the only other injuries he'd sustained were a sprained wrist and several broken fingers. Anthony, however, was looking at several days of hospitalization. Mike wondered if he'd still be there when Quinn returned at sunset. If he'd still be alive. It wasn't his responsibility, but Mike took care of hospital security anyway. Money was nothing, and Quinn's billfold had disappeared during the commotion. Mike kept quiet about that, paying extra to ensure that no one talked about where the money had come from. He was tired now that the adrenaline was wearing off, and he kept happily to himself as they left the hospital. To some vampires, a place to sleep was a place to sleep, no matter what or where it was. Mike knew some who didn't mind digging in for the day, though most of their kind didn't enjoy being reminded of having to crawl out of their graves. There were also those who could fall asleep in any bed, even in cellars, without a second thought about it. He was nothing like that. Either being raised by Beckett had made him paranoid, or maybe Mike was just smart, but sleeping away from his own home left him feeling uneasy. He wanted to be in his own bed. He hated the idea of using one that so many others, so many humans, had used before him. He stared at it disdainfully, scoffing at the candy on the pillow, and then looked at the window. The sun would be up soon. Mike could feel it like a little warning in his head. Get to safety. Stay out of danger. He had maybe an hour. He'd be cutting it fine, but the last thing he wanted to do was stay in the hotel room. Mike knew that losing himself in thought wasn't a particularly smart idea. Not when there was so much danger, and he wasn't in an area he hunted all that often. But he made sure to keep at least part of his mind on the task at hand. He was just finishing up with one of the city's homeless when he heard it. A short intake of breath, the scuff of rubber-soled shoes on pavement, the whisper of fingers stroking a wooden stake. What made it all the more interesting was that it was undoubtedly a vampire lurking in the shadows. He struck quickly, coming out from a darkened doorway and swinging the stake upward, putting all of his strength, all of his weight, behind the strike. Mike was still tired, sore, and a little weak from his recent blood loss, but he was able to sidestep the attack, spinning around and delivering a damaging punch to his assailant's kidney. The other vampire hissed in pain, falling into the scarred brick wall and dropping his makeshift weapon. It wasn't until he'd put some distance between them that Mike was able to see just who it was. A hood. Fucking Andrew. You underestimate us. The first words the kid had ever said to him. It felt like a lifetime ago. You underestimate us. It kept rattling around inside his head, echoing louder and louder. You underestimate us. Had they been planning it even then, almost 2 years ago? The thought made Mike furious. His fingers itched for something to grab, to rend into pieces. He took a deep breath and forced himself to be calm. Did it really take you this long to set something in motion? He asked, tilting his head to look at Andrew curiously. The street lamp reflected off the hood's yellow hair. He looked confused for a moment, before realization dawned on him. Well, you of all people should know about drawing out the moment, Andrew replied. How long was your boy gone for anyway? Did you even look for him? Mike scowled, but kept silent. He was used to taunts like these. His situation with Tom was, unfortunately, public knowledge. No, instead you just stayed here, sitting in that old woman's living room with a teacup and an untouched plate of cookies. That, however, was not. Mike stared at Andrew, knowing that his shock was visible but unable to hide it. The hood was smiling sweetly, all but rocking back and forth on his feet. In another moment, he would be laughing. How had he known? Mike had been so careful. He'd never gone straight there, had always been certain that he wasn't being followed. He'd never altered his usual routines, had found ways to work within them. In fact, the only time he'd ever seen another vampire had been John. And Mike was positive that John had been just as shocked as he'd been. John had never even brought it up again, never so much as looked at him differently. If he was going to say something, he'd have done it already, and he'd have spoken to Mike directly. John Walker was many things, not all of them good, but he had a strange sense of honor about him. Your secret stayed secret, because he'd expect no less from you. There was no one else, though. No one who might possibly use that bit of information against him. No one except... No. Mike pushed the thought out of his mind. It was impossible. The thought itself was too much like treason. Only it wasn't. Not anymore. He took a half step toward Andrew, intent on forcing the younger vampire to answer his questions. He had his hands around the hood's throat, was lifting him up off the ground when he caught sight of the sky. It was far too light for his liking. Now that he wasn't so preoccupied, Mike could hear his own internal clock screaming about the imminent sunrise. With a growl, he tightened his fingers around the hood's throat and threw him, hard, into the road. The air was thick with the sickening smell of vampire blood, but Mike didn't stay around long enough for the stench to cling to his clothes. He took off running down the street, eventually making his way up a fire escape so he could cross over the rooftops.
He got back to the hotel just as the first rays of the sunrise were starting to streak across the sky. And when he was finally in the safety of the lobby elevator, he had time to realize that his hand was throbbing. He looked down and saw that the skin was angry and red. Burnt. He woke early the next evening. Though it had happened several times in the last few days, it still left Mike feeling disconnected and off balance. He dressed quickly in the clothing that was left outside his door. More casual than he would have liked, but acceptable under the circumstances. There hadn't been time for custom tailored garments, even if the tailor across town already had his measurements. Once he was presentable, Mike grabbed the card key on the bedside table and headed to the room next door. Tom was already awake, slouched against the headboard. His eyes were drooping, and Mike wasn't sure if he'd just woken up or if he was ready to drop off again. "How do you feel?" he asked. Tom turned his head a little to look at him, but made a quiet sound of complaint. The bruises on his throat were ghastly. "All right," he said. "How are the others?" "All right," Mike replied. It might have been a bit of a lie, but they'd been fine last he'd heard. Spencer and Ryan in one room, John and Brendan in another. There was an awkward silence then, and it made Mike want to scowl. There was a time when things weren't so strange between them, when everything came so easily. It was upsetting to realize that was gone. "Everything is pretty fucked up," Tom said. It took Mike a moment to realize that the boy wasn't talking about the state of things between them. "Yes, they are," he replied. "We should have known better than to take the hunter's word for it without checking it out first. If we'd stopped to think about it, we'd have seen that they were using him. Briar said he'd rescued him once before. It must have made them angry." "They would have used him anyway," Tom said, his voice hoarse and painful to listen to. "They've been after him for a while. They don't seem to like out-of-town dandies." "What?" Mike asked sharply. Tom looked confused. "That's what they called him," he explained. "They said he was from out-of-town stock."
"Out-of-town stock. Gerard Way."
Mike knew full well that they'd kept the details of Way's visit under wraps. They'd known that letting that information get out would give the others all sorts of ideas. There was no way to hide that the hunters had been marked. That had been the whole point of doing it, really. But no one knew who'd done it, or why. No one outside the gang, at least. Mike wanted to go, to hit the streets and find the hunter, grab him by the throat and throttle him until he started answering the important questions. Had he told anyone the true story of what had happened? Had the others? It made no sense. There was no reason why they'd let that information slip out. But humans were stupid, prone to rash, ridiculous decisions that often backfired on them.
"What's wrong?"
Tom croaked. "Nothing," Mike said dismissively. "Stay here. Don't go outside." He waited for a smart-ass reply, and found himself strangely disappointed when none came. He looked at Tom again, took in the exhausted set of his shoulders, the heaviness of his eyes, and left him to rest. The meeting was held in the room that John shared with Brendan. It was a tight squeeze fitting everyone in, but those assembled had more important things on their mind, and no one complained about something as ridiculous as lack of space.
Mike walked into the room and, wanting to be as unobtrusive as possible, took a spot leaning against the wall near the balcony. He did his best to keep his mind on the meeting that would begin at any moment, but nothing he did could chase away Tom's words and the worries that had begun to clamor for his attention. Out of town stock. There were ways for them to have found out, Mike told himself firmly. Information traveled, and dandies weren't the only ones who made the occasional exchange between cities. Maybe Gerard hadn't been as discreet as he should have been. Except Gabriel had raised him, and Gabriel never did anything in half measures. Mike knew that Gerard understood the need for discretion. He wasn't about to risk the dynamics of his own city, not even despite this one. No, Mike's imagination was running wild, and he would do well to control it. One strange comment did not add up to conspiracy. Only, it wasn't just one isolated comment. Sitting in that old lady's living room. There was no way he'd been followed. He was certain of that. Mike was smart. He understood how to disappear if he needed to, how to avoid calling attention to himself when he wanted to fly under the radar. He'd known that something would happen if another vampire saw him at the house, that it would be both embarrassing and dangerous. He'd been so careful, confident that no one else would know about his scheme. But still, even though he'd been prepared for almost anything, Mike had figured that one person, at least, would find out. After all, this particular person had no problem joining in on someone else's game if he wasn't running one of his own. The thought made Mike uncomfortable, and he pushed it aside, even though he knew that it wasn't the kind of thing he could just ignore for long. He took a deep breath and began to survey the other dandies, pausing for a moment on their injured. Briar was propped against the headboard of one bed, still in bad shape and no doubt moving slower than usual, though he looked better than Greenwald. Alex lay on the other bed, as pale as the white shirt he was wearing. He clearly hadn't fed enough the night before, but Mike tried to put all thoughts of Tom and Alex out of his mind. Instead, he focused on the fact that neither Briar nor Alex would be any use in a fight. Greenwald must have sensed someone staring at him, because he turned to meet Mike's gaze. The mesmerist quickly turned his attention to the nearest person, almost rolling his eyes when he saw it was Brendan. The younger vampire was jumpy, with an unhappy tilt to his mouth, and hands that kept opening and closing at his sides. He was itching to get out on the street and didn't want to waste time. Mike figured he could thank Ryan for that. The kid was apparently great motivation when his life was threatened. He wondered how long Brendan would allow that to continue. "Here's what we know," John said as he came into the room and shut the door firmly behind himself. He didn't shout to get anyone's attention. In fact, he barely pitched his voice loud enough to be heard over the chaos of nearly 40 dandies in one room, but all fell silent as soon as he opened his mouth, everyone giving him their full attention. "Everyone but Nate, Michael, and Greta has been accounted for." "Sure," Mike thought uncharitably. "If by accounted for you meant found dead." He kept the comment to himself, though one look at Fowler told him that the other dandy was about ready to say it out loud. John gave him an unhappy look, and Fowler's face settled into a scowl, but he kept quiet. "Nate could very well still be alive, though I'm not willing to abandon hope for the others." "So says one of Wentz's hunters," Lacey commented. "A reliable one," Briar said, glaring from his position on the bed,
He shifted a little, trying to prop himself up a little straighter. If Mike had actually liked him, he might have felt a little impressed. It was almost impossible to look menacing while injured and barely able to sit upright on your own.
That brings us to what we still need to know, John continued. Whether Joe is or is not reliable is a very large issue, John said to Briar. I want my people back, and I want to end this. We need to talk to this kid. We need to know how the story was circulating, and whether or not Joe was being used to spread false information in the hope that it would get back to us. I'm not prepared to send more of us out than need be, not until we know exactly what is going on and we're able to plan accordingly.
He paused then, taking a moment to look at his people.
I need someone in charge of picking him up.
There it was, the perfect opportunity Mike had been searching for. He'd wanted to interrogate the hunter, to force him to answer truthfully, and here John was, all but offering it to him. If Mike hadn't known better, if things weren't still so tense between them, he'd have thought John was doing it on purpose.
I'll do it, Mike replied, just narrowly beating the butcher. Butcher glared at him, but Mike pretended not to notice.
Besides, his motives were far more important than the butcher's quest for revenge against Pete Wentz. If Mike did this properly, he was about to put some very nasty doubts to rest, and that would have to take priority. John nodded at him, looking a little surprised that he'd volunteered for the job. For a moment, Mike thought he'd ask questions, but after pursing his lips, he seemingly decided to keep those particular comments to himself.
Fine, he said. Talk to Briar, he'll point you in the right direction.
He turned then, picking up one of the cheap ballpoint pens from the desk in the corner, and moving closer to the wall. Showing no concern about the vandalism he was about to commit, he began drawing a map of their city on the wall, taking care with the boundaries and marking off several areas with slightly lopsided squares.
This is Hood territory, John said, pointing to one part of the map. Our second task tonight is to find their safe house. We're going to burn it to the ground, but first we need to make sure our people aren't inside. We have to be subtle about this. They'll be expecting it, and they'll be on the lookout. I've marked off some likely areas.
He gestured toward the squares.
The territory is right in the middle of the city, and they're surrounded by us and the punks. No one in that situation is stupid enough to house their people near the borders. They have to be toward the center of the territory. I need one person to check out each location. We're not going in cold. That can only end badly.
Again, Brendan said.
Yes, John agreed. I remember when a safe house was sacred,
Briar commented. Every vampire in the room turned to look at him, much the way they did every time he mentioned something from the old days. It was slightly irritating to both dislike someone and value their knowledge at the same time.
I was standing next to Schechter when that was agreed upon, he continued. Don't look for ours, and we won't look for yours. It was one of our most important laws. How times change.
Yes, John said.
They do.
There was a moment of silence before John continued.
Brendan, Butcher, Sean, and Quinn, you'll each take a location on the map. Make sure you're not seen. We want to preserve what little element of surprise we have left.
The discussion with Briar had been frustratingly unhelpful, with the elder vampire reluctant to provide more than a few vague details about where the hunter might be found. Mike knew that Briar had most likely found Wentz's hiding place,
by dumb luck or through careful searching, and had no intention of revealing it. Only the knowledge that Briar was acting based on some twisted familial loyalty to the humans kept Mike from pitching a fit. Protecting Wentz was just a nasty side effect of it all. Kind of how not kicking up a fuss in the hopes of keeping Tom settled had the unfortunate side effect of letting Greenwald get away with what he'd done. Eventually, Mike was able to get enough information from Briar that he was able to figure out where to start searching. He left soon after, resisting the urge to check in on Tom again. There was no point, no dignity, in hovering. The last thing he wanted to do was turn into Brendan. He forced himself to set a leisurely pace, almost meandering in its speed and the indirect path he chose. He didn't want to seem too purposeful if he was spotted. That particular piece of news would travel way too fast, and his search would be over before it even begun. Mike wasn't entirely surprised to find himself being followed after a few minutes. What did surprise him, however, was the fact that it was another dandy who hung back just far enough that Mike couldn't see him on the few occasions that he turned and tried to sneak a surreptitious glance. It didn't take long for him to grow tired of the game, so he paused at the corner and leaned against a telephone pole, waiting to see what his shadow would do. After a moment, the other dandy came into view, pausing as he stepped out of an alley, offering a sly little smile. It was Greenwald. "You look like death," Mike said. "Almost dying will do that to you," Alex replied. He came closer then, stopping when he was a few feet away. His hands slipped casually into his pockets. "You saw what I did," he continued after a moment. "I'm not the only one," Mike replied tersely. He didn't want to discuss this. If they talked about it, he'd have to do something. And Mike was having trouble coming up with something that didn't involve finishing the job the Hoods had started. He'd be well within his rights to challenge the other dandy. He was sure of that, envoy or not. But there was something about the way Tom's fingers had been fisted in Alex's shirt that told him very clearly that the new Tom Conrad at the hotel, the old Tom Conrad that had first caught Mike's eye, would disappear very quickly if he did anything of the sort. "I'm sure you won't believe me when I say this, but it's the truth. That wasn't done on purpose, Carden." "You didn't just allow yourself to nearly die on the off chance that he'd be able to humiliate me in public by feeding from my human? I never would have figured that out on my own," Mike snapped. "That won't get us anywhere," Alex said. "Don't," Mike warned, raising a hand to stop him. "Don't stand there and do an impression of Brian Schechter. You are not him." "No, I'm not," Alex agreed. "But since you've brought him up, let me tell you a story. He won't be pleased, but there's no sense in hiding it anymore." Mike watched Alex warily, wondering which secrets the other dandy was about to give up. He'd be lying if he said the thought of it didn't give him a thrill. "Schechter has had Tom in his sights for a very long time," Alex began.
"So you're admitting that he broke our laws then?" Mike said.
It was strange. He didn't feel any triumph in knowing. Not like he'd expected to.
"No,"
Alex said, shaking his head and smiling a little.
"Years, Carden. Schechter's been watching him since he was 8 years old."
"Bullshit," Mike snapped. "If you're going to waste my time, Greenwald..." "How old was Tom when he first picked up a camera?" Alex pressed. Anyone else would think he was changing the subject, but not Mike. No, he knew the answer to that question. He learned it over tea and toffee scones in an old woman's shabby living room.
He was 8, Mike replied warily.
Did you look into the university he'd enrolled in? Alex asked.
Once you found out, did you do any digging?
Of course he had. He'd spent days poring over websites and newsletters, course books and even financial records, desperate to understand.
Obviously, he said tersely.
The Schechter School of Photography, Alex said, his smile returning.
Founded when?
15 years ago, Carden. Tom was 8.
No, there was no way. Mike refused to believe it, except Brian Schechter was known for playing the long game. It was part of what terrified everyone around him, the knowledge that your decisions might not even be your own, not if he knew the outcomes and was prepared to steer you into whichever scenario worked best for him.
He was never really yours, Carden. Not really.
You said it like it makes a difference. It doesn't, Mike snarled. Tom agreed to stay with me. He took the mark and made his promise. He doesn't get to take that back.
He does if you let him, Alex said softly.
Mike glared, clenching his fists and shoving them angrily into his pockets. The arrogance, the sheer audacity of that statement grated on his nerves, making him even angrier every moment he spent staring at the other vampire.
You come here and throw everything into chaos, Mike accused. You take what you want and damn the consequences because it's not you who will be left to clean it up.
Well, I can't do that, Greenwald. I can't turn my back and pretend like everything will work out. I don't have a seer to make sure that the pieces fall where I need them to.
It's never been that easy for us, Alex said after a moment.
You make it sound like we don't have to work for what we want, like we don't make our own mistakes and suffer just as much as you do. He's not always right, you know. And sometimes that makes things harder for everyone.
What? Mike asked, a little thrown by the last statement.
Tom has been my sire's pet project for the last 15 years. Everything hinged on keeping him alive because he was so important.
Alex gave a bitter little laugh and shook his head.
But not even he sees everything, not in crystal clear detail. And sometimes even he gets it wrong.
Cut to the chase, Mike demanded.
Schechter kept Tom because he was important, Alex explained. But it turns out that he was only important because Schechter kept him.
Paradox, Mike whispered. Alex nodded sadly.
He was going to save my life, he said. My life only needed saving because of him. I don't regret it, though, and I'm sure Schechter won't either. He's lost so many children over the centuries, you know. You can't blame him for wanting to prevent it from happening again.
How do you know that it happened last night? Mike asked.
Their lives were inherently dangerous. There would undoubtedly be plenty of life-threatening events to come.
I'm going to have a scar, Alex said, holding up his left hand.
There was a small, raised pink line near his wrist, something Mike wouldn't have noticed unless it had been pointed out. He must have gotten one hell of a splinter. Mike didn't know how he was supposed to feel. He stared at Greenwald in disbelief, wanting to say something but unable to come up with anything suitable. In truth, he didn't care that Schechter had been watching Tom since he'd been a child. The only thing that mattered was who'd gotten to him first,
and that had clearly been him.
But still, there was something about hearing the extent of the other dandy's scheming. Scheming that had backfired so spectacularly that unsettled Mike. He needed to be alone, needed to think about what all of this really meant. Shaking his head, he took a step backward, and another, before turning his back to Greenwald and starting down the sidewalk.
Carden. Mike!
Mike stopped, but he didn't turn around.
What do you want?
He asked.
I want to take him home,
Alec said softly.
No matter what Schechter's part was in all of this, I know my own mind. I want to take Tom home. Everyone's so worried that it'll turn out wrong,
Mike replied.
Then don't turn him, Alec said. Problem solved. Mike didn't trust himself to reply to that.
He resettled the hat on his head and hurried away.
Even though he had work to do, it still felt a little like running away.